This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ.
This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 42, where today we're going to talk about a new pattern for creating applications for Office 365 in an interview with Scott Hillier, recorded live August 13th, 2014. Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it. Good morning, CJ. How are you?
Very well, thank you, AC. Very well. How about yourself?
Doing good. That was my very subtle and short tribute to the now recently passed Robin Williams. That's a major bummer, man.
Nanu.
God, that was a major bummer. There are, you know, aside from people who are close to you, people that you know hear about that are no longer with us. Very rarely does it really affect me. I was looking at my wife last night. And we were seeing some of the stuff on the news talking about Robin Williams. And I think there's only one other person that has really bothered me. Their passing really, really bothered me. This one was, I just found myself just kind of like going back and watching clips of his movies and stuff. And just,
yeah,
this might sound kind of sappy, but just getting sad.
Yep. I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. It was very sad. Very, very sad. And so, it's so unfortunate that, you know, some of the funniest people in the world are so torn up inside.
You know, I saw a session at a conference I went to a couple months ago, and this guy, it was a startups kind of a conference. And this guy was talking about like mental health and stuff. And he said that, you know, some of the greatest minds suffer from a mental health problem, like the Michelangelos and the Beethovens and all those guys. They some of the best guys or some of the best people, most creative, and the people who have had so much to contribute to our society, how they had a mental illness. And like, it's kind of weird that there's, I don't want to say correlation, but let's just say coincidence, because I don't think you have to have a mental illness to have a huge contribution to society. But it's just interesting to hear all the people that, you know, where that's been an interesting coincidence.
There's definitely something that comes with being ultra creative or a genius that I think makes or leads to a strong susceptibility to mental illness.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I know a few folks, I say a few, it makes it sound like a lot, but a couple of folks close to me that are that suffer the same sort of hyper creative, but also hyper susceptible to depression.
Yeah. It's challenging, but yeah. So, not with us anymore. But they gave me some great memories. So, thank you very much, Robin Williams.
Likewise.
But okay. So let's get on with the show here. Before we dive into the meat of the show here, we got a little bit of I guess news and updates and stuff. So let me first start off with you, CJ. You know, what have you been up to in the last week or so?
I was off on vacation last week over in Lake Chelan, Eastern Washington. So got out on a boat on the lake and hung out and took some R&R after the crazy event season that has been. So thoroughly enjoyed that. Just before that, actually, right before I went away on vacation, I did a tour of the Microsoft Operations Center, the NOC. The Microsoft Network Operations Center, the NOC, the NOC. And this is a place, there's a few of them around the world, a undisclosed number of them around the world. And it's basically where Microsoft runs its network operations from, right? So all of the networking and infrastructure for all of its cloud services, for all of its web properties, through to everything from, you know, Xbox Live through to MSN, through to Office 365, all of those things, and all of its internal network around the world, and the network that it uses to run all of those online properties, and all of the gateways to the internet around the world that network has. And so it was absolutely fascinating. And and just hearing about how the network is run. And I actually I got to tour the center with a couple of folks from Nintex that I arranged the tour for, and so we went and heard from them about, you know, what happens in an incident and how things work and all the different teams involved and what happens. And then we got to tour the sort of, you know, dark room with lots of people tapping on keyboards and lots of blinking lights and big monitors up on the wall and all of that sort of stuff, and seeing the day-to-day operations of what happens in a place like that, which is, for me, was really interesting because I haven't seen a lot of that stuff before like that, and I found it fascinating.
I love those things. I love, like, the, I guess, behind, it's not so much behind the scenes to see how the sausage is made, but it's just how do you run the business, and with an operation that is so significant, it's fascinating. I've been able to do that one time. But it was a very long time ago when I was working for a financial services company that serviced over half the mortgages of all the mortgages in the United States between all the different banks. But and then I did it again, I guess, earlier this year with the mission control for the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab. But I think that, you know, seeing these different there's this theme that you see where more and more companies have like these engineering blogs, and they're exposing more behind the scenes of what they do and the thoughts that go behind it. And it's not so much like what you saw, but the more companies are somewhat transparent about that, you get I think that you get more reassurance from those companies when you understand what some of their processes are. And like, for example, was it Netflix, where they've got their engineering blog, they go so much to show so much of the stuff they do. And you know, everyone's familiar with their what's it called? Chaos Monkey and all that
Chaos
stuff.
Chaos Monkey. Yeah.
So the Simian Army. And
but yeah, I was stunned. You know, we asked a question about failover, like what happens in certain situations and things. And, you know, these guys are on a building on the main Microsoft campus. This is where the Redmond based NOC is. And they've got it down so that, you know, even if they need to shut the power off to this building, then the NOC can fail over to another location on the main campus. And then if main campus is out for some reason, then they can fail over to a NOC in Bellevue. And then if the Pacific Northwest disappears below the ocean, then they can fail over to a number of different NOCs around the world, one being Hyderabad, there's another one in Europe and so forth. And so, like, even if something really hyper local happens, they can go elsewhere on campus and still continue operations, then go to Bellevue, which is only a, you know, 10-minute drive away. And then if those are down, then it goes offshore.
That's like real world Jack Bauer 24 time. Like, send that over to my screen.
Yeah, and just interesting seeing how the different services are segmented. So, you know, Skype has obviously teams that run the Skype system, and they're all integrated as well. But there's different NOCs around the world that specifically deal with certain services like Xbox Live, Yammer, Skype, and so forth. Mm. So it was really, really interesting, and it's amazing to sort of have a little peek behind the curtain and see how it all hangs together.
I have one question about it. Is there a big red holy shit button? And I just, you know.
yeah, I didn't see one. I got to tell you, but one thing that really surprised me was that. So it's a 24/7 operation, right? There's obviously somebody in that room all the time, and it sort of follows the sun around the world, right? But I never really thought about it all that much, about what it takes to run a network of that size and that complexity. But they had different people on different, you know, effectively teams. Like, you know, some would be doing, you know, routing, and some would be doing security stuff, and some would be doing different things. And so each sort of team is quite segmented. So it's almost like there's sort of five little knocks in one, so to speak.
Yeah,
but no big holy button. And I didn't see any big red easy buttons either. So no. It all looked pretty hard to me.
There was I forgot the other one. I have been in a knock. It was with the Department of Defense. So one of the security agencies, or one of the intelligence agencies for the Department of Defense, I worked there for about a year, and I was there when the second Iraq war started, the night that the war started. and was on, I maintained like two or three different systems. And so I was on what's called the essential operations list. And there was a special lane on the highway for, well, not special lane, but there's a special traffic pattern on the highway right outside the base to get us in and everything. And when we knew, we anticipated a war starting. And if the war started, we were supposed to report in right away. And I won't go into too much detail of it just because I don't think I'm supposed to. But I do remember seeing that, you know, there's different networks with the Department of Defense where there's one called CIPRNET and NIPRNET. Those are not connected to the internet except in specific points. So if they can kill the connection to the internet and still have an internal Department of Defense network, watching the attacks coming in from all the countries that you would regularly expect to try to penetrate our network, watching it skyrocket when the war started was fascinating. So
interesting. Yeah,
there definitely was somebody in the room that they might not have had the, you know, the holy shit button, but the holy button, you know, I'll make sure I censor some of this stuff out. Need to go find a better censoring noise, but yeah. So that's cool. I've been working on, I got a project actually that recently just went live, that was actually done for part of your team. That's something we're going to talk about. So I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, but, I guess for news that's related to me, I'm doing a SharePoint 2013 application developer class or SharePoint app model class, in Tampa in early October for critical path training. So if anybody's interested in joining me down in Tampa, October the 6th through the 10th. And I've been also diving in quite deeply into the patterns and practices stuff that's come out of the Office 365 team. That's all up on GitHub. So it's, I tell you what, man, I keep saying you guys, because I guess it's part of your organization, but those guys created a bunch of samples. They originally were in CodePlex. They've since moved over to GitHub. And they're really good samples. There's a lot of good code reuse. There's like a central library and then lots of samples and scenarios that leverage the simple sample library for some reusable pieces. But man, I'm sitting here this morning working on some stuff. I noticed two or three things that I thought should have been different. I forked the repository. I made a few changes, committed them to mine, submitted a pull request, and within about 2 hours, my changes have been merged in. Now, granted, they were not major, but it was pretty cool. So,
yeah, that's been a really you mentioned it was on CodePlex before. We used CodePlex as a publishing point, but it wasn't open source. And the fact that you couldn't submit the equivalent of pull requests, right? So you couldn't submit changes to the code, and that was very much sort of a one way street, right? It was a bunch of folks internally. Sort of led by Vesa and Steve Walker, who were publishing these things, and it was very much about just getting it out. And we've been working for the last couple of months on scrubbing it all up and getting it ready for release, then also moving it over to GitHub. And the team are in the process of migrating all of the documents that were in docx format over to Markdown and things, so it's all really easy to submit changes, not only to the code, but also to the documentation. And the uptake, or the pickup in it's been really interesting. I think I was talking to Jeremy Thake, who's on my team, yesterday, and he said, I think we've had like 1,500 unique users in the last like week and a half or something on that repo. And I can't remember how many pull requests he said that we've already had from folks submitted, but it's great to see, right? That's the whole point of sticking it on GitHub and open sourcing it, was so that people could submit, you know, bug fixes or features or documentation changes, and that's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's only been on CodePlex now for what, like a week or two, and I'm looking at it right now, and including mine, there's been 11. There's 11 closed pull requests and one that's still open, but it's only been open for about 5 hours. So that's really cool. It's really cool. We should do a show just on this one sample here, because there's a lot of really good stuff here. So
yeah, for sure.
Anyway, for sure. The other thing too, just as a quick bit of news before we do a little intro here, is that I know you guys also, your team also shipped a update to the Office 365 API tools for Visual Studio 2013. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, as well as the blog post that goes through all the improvements and changes. A lot of bug fixes, but there's a ton of changes in it as well, and code changes around authenticating with a 365 sample or 365 API.
Yeah, and getting access to those things, using those tools from other platforms like Windows and things like that.
Yep. Yeah. So, well, one of the I guess the meat of the show is, I don't want to make this show too long because I know we have an interview that I want to play here, but earlier this week I guess on August the 12th, there's a blog post that we'll link to on the Office blogs, the dev or the blogs.office.com site, that includes two AngularJS standalone website samples that were shipped, and they're on the Office Dev GitHub organization account. So you'll be able to get links to all of these. One of them is an expense tracker application that was done by the very, very esteemed Dan Wallin, who's traditionally an ASP.NET and AngularJS single-page app guy, that hasn't so much been in the SharePoint space, but he did a really good sample for you guys that was published. But the one that I really wanted to highlight here, that I want to talk about, is one that I did in conjunction with Scott Hillier. And it's around, there's three different projects associated with it. Scott and I, we talked a lot about it. The interview is, I interviewed Scott last week, talking a little bit about these samples. But there's three samples. One is a single page app using Angular. One is an Outlook web app extension for the Outlook web app. And then one is a custom task pane for the Office, for an Office app, for a desktop app. But the big thing here that I think that Scott and I sampled, what we had done is that we showed you in all of these samples to where we created these apps that interfaced with Office 365, in our case, specifically SharePoint Online. But we didn't do anything at all inside of Office 365 and SharePoint in terms of configuration. All of them are based on having the same Active Directory that is shared between Office 365 tenant and an Azure tenant. And we created an application in Azure AD and then did single sign-on and did everything as just ASP.NET, MVC applications or whatever that talked, that did not talk directly to SharePoint. They talked to Azure instead and then interfaced straight back to Office 365. So,
gotcha. The interesting, one of the interesting things, it's a great project. Like, it's a really, really cool reference project that, or reference implementation, I guess, an interesting pattern that people should go use or look at least to before they start their project to with Office 365 to go take a look at. But one of the really interesting things about it from my perspective is that it's not only just a web application that goes and talks to, you know, Office 365 behind the scenes, but that it's also components of the app land in Outlook and also in Word as well, right? So you've got the main web application that somebody would use when they're sitting at their desktop with a browser open, but then also you've demonstrated how to connect part of that application into Outlook using, you know, the app model to do that. And then also the same for Word as well. So surfacing pieces of your application in different locations. And I'm going to get a little marketecture-y here, but we call these like contextual apps, right? Where depending on what context you're in, you want to surface different parts of your app. So when you're in Word, for example, you might surface a piece of your application that makes sense for that person when they're using Word. And it can be sort of right alongside their document. Or, you know, the Outlook example that you guys have got is pretty cool too. So when you're in a mail, it's contextual to that mail, and you can take an activity or do an activity in that app right within Outlook. And so that's that concept of kind of contextual pieces of your application in different locations.
Yeah.
And so what's cool about it is a lot of examples just show one of these things in a silo, but this reference implementation shows an app that spans all of that stuff together and connects the dots, which is really cool.
Agreed. Yeah. So we have a lot of different scenarios that we're trying to show here about different opportunities for developers to jump into. But let's quit the going back and forth here. Let's go ahead and just jump straight into the interview with Scott. I want you to also take note of a little bit of a discussion that we had around access tokens and securing those. And after the interview, we'll come back, chat a little bit more about it. So let's go ahead and roll the interview. All right. So today we have a guest with us. We have Scott Hillier. Scott is an independent consultant and Microsoft SharePoint Most Valuable Professional focused on creating solutions for information workers with SharePoint, Office, and related technologies. He's the author and co-author of 18 plus books on Microsoft technologies, including Inside SharePoint 2013 and App Development in SharePoint 2013. Scott splits his time between consulting on SharePoint projects, managing developer content on IT Unity, speaking at SharePoint events, and delivering SharePoint developer training through Critical Path Training. Scott is a former U.S. Navy submarine officer and graduate of the Virginia Military Institute, and he can be reached at scott@scotthillier.net, and that's Scott with one T. So how are you doing today, Scott?
Good, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I wanted to have you on the show today to talk about something that you and I worked on recently, but I'm going to let you kind of run the show. You and I recently built a couple of sample projects for Microsoft that are public, and we'll talk about the links of where people can get them towards the end of the show, where we did some kind of some new and interesting stuff and some new kind of application patterns. And so I wanted to kind of go over these with you a little bit and share some stuff with our listeners, some challenges that you and I ran into, and some things about why more specifically, why you find this interesting for our listeners. So how's that sound today?
Sounds great.
Awesome. Awesome. So why don't you talk a little bit about what this reference, we call it the reference tracker, or the research tracker project. Why don't you talk a little bit about what this is from a high level, and what components we kind of leveraged here?
Yeah. Okay. So let me back up just a little bit here and just talk a little bit more generally about SharePoint development and what's going on these days. I think everybody knows, right, that we're moving from an on-premises type development scenarios more into cloud development scenarios. And we've been following along on the app model for the last couple of years and launching our apps from within in SharePoint and creating provider-hosted apps, SharePoint-hosted apps. But really, another pattern is emerging along with this, and this is the pattern where you have an application that's outside of SharePoint. It's just a good old web application written with web forms or MVC5, and then what you want to do is call back into SharePoint. So we're looking at SharePoint more like it's a resource in much the same way that you would access any internet resource. And how do we access that resource, use those resources in an application that maybe isn't launched from within SharePoint, isn't really part of it, of the app model? And along with that, we had a couple of goals. We were trying with this project to show how we could accomplish that pattern of being outside SharePoint and calling into SharePoint while still keeping the great user experience embodied in a single page application. And we'll talk about some of the challenges of creating that, I'm sure, as we go along. But that was basically what we're trying to do. And so the scenario we used was this research tracker that you mentioned. And the idea is that with this research tracker, you would be able to do some research, you know, where you're collecting, say, links from the internet or documents or what have you on a particular topic. And as you collect them, you want to be able to store that information. And so we're using SharePoint resources to store that information. So basically what we're creating is a single page application that uses SharePoint lists as a back end to it, and trying to create that entire thing as a SPA. And then we have a couple of related apps that go along with it, where we then utilize that shared, that stored information in Outlook and Word.
Oh, cool. So, okay, let's kind of pick this apart a little bit. So you said that we're leveraging SharePoint as kind of like our data store, and then we've built these three separate applications that are, to clarify to the listener, these are completely separate from SharePoint. They're completely independent, self-standing, and they're not deployed from within SharePoint. So how much stuff that we have to go through and deploy inside of SharePoint or inside of Office 365, or how much configuration has to be done to get these to work?
Well, so the interesting part about all three of these is that there's really nothing that's required to be done inside of SharePoint itself. Our work to allow these applications the authorization to call back into SharePoint was really done in Azure Active Directory. And I think that's one of the key takeaways for people, is that you're able to create now these Azure Active Directory applications where your application gets registered with Azure, and then in the Azure Active Directory, you can also grant permissions for that to reach into other resources. So we were able to register applications in Azure Active Directory and then give them rights to call into SharePoint. And this stands in contrast to the normal provider-hosted app model, where you actually register the app with SharePoint itself. And it's SharePoint that's keeping track of the client ID and the permissions. So really a different model, but using a lot of the same ideas that you would use in a provider-hosted app, but truly nothing really required inside of SharePoint to get it up and running.
Okay, and so if we compare and contrast kind of this idea of how probably most people are familiar in creating SharePoint or provider-hosted applications or cloud-hosted apps for SharePoint / Office 365 or these Azure apps, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we do it the former way of a more SharePoint hosted app or a provider hosted app, that's going to be a little bit more of a seamless process or an easier install process for the end users or for the administrators, because they'll be able to grab these apps straight from the SharePoint store or from their catalog, their corporate catalog, to really install and register these inside of SharePoint. Whereas with the Azure app side, and the part that we've done in these demos for the reference tracker or the research tracker application, there's going to be a little bit more of a manual setup, although, and we could probably do some command line tools with it, but it's not so much of a point and click install. You have to go set something up in Azure and then deploy the code to Azure, and then your application can leverage this application that you've defined in Azure.
Yeah, so I don't disagree with what you're saying. I mean, I would hate to paint this as overly difficult for your listeners, but there is no concept of of a catalog in this style of development. So you're not going, I think what you're not going to have is you're not going to have a scenario where business users can browse available applications and then install the one they want. This is really more of a line of business or enterprise system that has involved developers and IT folks who are going to go ahead and install this application inside of Azure and grant it its permission. So more of an installation process by your IT professionals than a, you know, browse and select by your business folks. I think that's the difference. But in either case, I don't think there's anything overly arduous here about getting the application up into Azure. After all, even if you did a provider-hosted app, you'd still want to run that thing in an Azure website.
Yeah, that's okay. That's a good point. That's a good point. So, and when the app does any interaction with SharePoint, is it just treated the exact same way as we would see an app inside of SharePoint, where, you know, let's take the easiest example, and if the Azure application went in and created an item inside of a SharePoint list at the bottom of the page where it says created by, is it going to say the same thing we normally see with like a SharePoint app where it says created by name of the application on behalf of John Doe? I mean, it works the same way. It works the same way as like a traditional SharePoint app does. It's treated as an app in SharePoint. It's just defined and deployed over in Azure.
Well, it's right. So you'll see some of those similarities, but I think the difference is where the registration and permissions are granted. So that's in Azure Active Directory, as opposed to, say, going to the AppReg new page in SharePoint and doing your registration there.
Okay.
But the model, you know, the concept of the application working on behalf of the user is still there, right? We're using OAuth tokens to gain authorization to get back in, which is exactly the same thing that would happen if you launched the app from within SharePoint.
I see. So let's talk then a little bit then about like some challenges that we ran into, or some, maybe not so much challenges, but if someone was doing this for the very first time, they've got some things that they're going to have to figure out that they may not be familiar with. So what are the big things here that you see that this being so different from doing a SharePoint or a provider-hosted app?
Well, so one of the nice things about doing the provider-hosted apps inside of the SharePoint world is that we have some reasonably mature code behind us. So, for example, if you make an MVC5 provider-hosted app that's going to run inside of SharePoint Online, then you can use the SharePoint Context class that comes with that project template to do really most of your OAuth token management. So in just a couple of lines of code, you'd be able to get the access token you need in order to make the calls back into SharePoint. So a lot of the OAuth management is really hidden from you. It's abstracted away to just a few lines of code. Now, for sure, we've got some things that are approaching that level of abstraction inside of this model. But I think we found that we had to get a little bit more involved with the OAuth process, the redirects that were involved, the storing of the token, than we really ever had to do when we were creating provider-hosted apps inside of SharePoint. So it is useful to understand the OAuth process, how the how you get a refresh token, how that refresh token gets the access token, how those tokens are saved. And that sort of helps you get through the architecture of this thing, whereas I think you can be a little bit more ignorant of that if you were making a simple provider-hosted app inside of SharePoint.
Oh, okay. So you've got you're gonna have to go through and create, do the authentication stuff on your own. You have to go through and deal with obtaining the token and stuff. What options then are we going to have then in terms of authentication? So. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. So I think the key thing for people, if they haven't done this thing before, is to really understand the need to defend the OAuth token so that it doesn't get exposed. If you're not really familiar with how OAuth works and its concepts, it's important to be familiar as you begin to move into this new style of programming. But essentially, the most important thing to understand about OAuth tokens is that they're bearer tokens. And what a bearer token means is that that token is independent of the application that utilizes it. The same token can be used by any application. It's not signed for one particular application. So bearer tokens are often described as cash. Whoever has it can spend it, right? And what that means to us as designers of these types of applications is that we have to be careful to never put the OAuth token in a place where it could be exposed. So what that means in particular for the type of thing we're doing, particularly with this spa application, is that we should not allow the OAuth token to become exposed in JavaScript or to be exposed to debugging tools that can be used in the browser. So we don't want a JavaScript variable set to it. We don't want to bury it in code in JavaScript, any of that stuff. So we only want to handle those OAuth tokens on the server side. And when it comes to getting a token and managing that token, there's really a couple of different approaches at this point. One is to use the OAuth controller, which is a special controller that you can get out of GitHub that was created as a sample, but basically manages the OAuth process for you in code. And you can use it sort of on the outside, you know, abstract yourself away a bit from the process, but you can also get into the code and see how it's working. And you can make modifications to the OAuth controller in order to manage any special cases you have. So the OAuth controller gives you a lot of flexibility, but requires a little bit more work on your part to get it going. And then the other approach that we used is the O365 APIs. So the Office 365 APIs is an ongoing process. Those tools are currently in preview. And that ongoing process is creating a more and more mature tool set. But the idea is to abstract you away from the OAuth process, much the same way that I was talking about how the SharePoint context does that for you in the provider-hosted app. Hmm. So right now, those give you a little bit better level of abstraction, but they're a little bit more, they're more sealed, if you will, so harder to change things if you needed to change them. But the takeaway from all that is, you have to have some way to authenticate with Azure Active Directory and retrieve, refresh, and access tokens without ever exposing them on the JavaScript side of the house, while at the same time building a single page application that never wants to post back.
Okay, so you mentioned two different authentication options. One, using some sort of an OAuth controller, which we obtained from one of the Azure samples in GitHub. And I'll make sure that we have references to those.
Put a link out there so people can check it out.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that. And then the other option is using like the Office 365 APIs. And again, those are in preview mode. The tools keep getting refreshed. I believe they're up to either update 2 or 3 about now. But we show you how to use both of those different options inside the samples. Now, you touched on a little bit of having to secure the access token because it's like cash or currency, and we don't want this to touch the JavaScript client. I know that, you know, in a lot of the research you and I did, it seemed like the industry was kind of split down the middle. On one camp said it's okay if it touches the client as long as everything's SSL. The other side of the camp was the access token should never touch the client, because then if the client is compromised, then or if the client is nefarious and they're trying to actually grab the token for something, they can look at the JavaScript code and they can do something with it. So we took the more safe approach and just saying the access token can't touch the server. So can you talk a little bit about like what we did between, you know, how we had a single page application and then this Outlook app that runs in the client and this Word app that runs on the user's desktop? How did we keep that access token secure, but then again making sure that the user was authenticated and tying their client session to this access token we were retaining on the server side for that one user?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so you're right about, you know, I guess there's some debate about whether or not it's okay to expose an OAuth token. You know, we could probably do a whole other session on OAuth and its strengths and weaknesses, but we definitely took the more conservative approach, which I would recommend to anybody, to make sure this thing never became exposed on the JavaScript side. And the way that we did that was we made an MVC5 application, and inside MVC server side, and then produce HTML views that run on the client side. And in combination with that, we used a web API controller that could be called from the code that came out of the initial view. So this gave us a couple of different things. When the app loads, it gives us a controller that runs server side prior to the HTML view being displayed. So the approach that we took was to log in during that initial load of the application when the controller is running server side. So look for the tokens. If they're not there, redirect the user to the appropriate organizational login page, grab the tokens that are passed back to us, and save them into session state all before the initial single page app appears. Then once the single page app appears, your goal is to never have to leave that page. Obviously, it's a spa, right? It's the whole point. So the way that we accomplished that was by introducing a web API controller that could be called from the spa. Now, this works because the spa and the web API controller are in the same project, and therefore they come from the same origin, and we don't violate same origin policy, so the JavaScript in the initial view, the single page, can make as many calls as it wants to the web API controller. On the server side, the web API controller has access to the same session state that the initial controller did, and so it's able to retrieve the OAuth tokens from session state and make subsequent REST calls to SharePoint using that OAuth token. So all of the calls to SharePoint get made on the server side. They never get made in JavaScript. So we've introduced this proxy, if you will, of an additional web API controller that will make all the subsequent calls to SharePoint from the server side. And that's the basic model.
I see. Okay. And so there's a little bit of a UML diagram in the GitHub project that we'll reference in the show notes. But it shows how really what you were just describing, which is the single page app, the Outlook add-in, the Outlook web app plugin, and the desktop Word client task pane plugin that are all created in this little reference implementation, none of them directly talk to Office 365 or SharePoint. The only thing that they ever talk to is this intermediary proxy ASP.NET web API, MVC5/web API project that we've created that handles the kind of the authentication and the secure communication. They can only talk straight to that one piece, and then we're kind of like a little custom gateway into 365 to protect the access token.
Yeah, I would correct that just a little bit. When it comes to the Office apps, remember you have a whole JavaScript library designed to allow the Office apps to interact with the Office products. So for sure, we're using all of that. But what's happening in those cases is we're, again, executing the OAuth code prior to the app loading. So by the time the Office app is loaded, all the OAuth stuff is already taken care of. And we're just at that point interacting with the Office application itself. So we still have that ability. When your listeners go and check out the things that we made, they're going to see that we have a Word add-in that has gathered all the information from SharePoint on that initial load and is showing it to you in the task pane, and you can insert it into your document. And all of that's happening through the normal Office JavaScript library. But for sure, the OAuth stuff all still happens on the server.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. Oh, very cool. Definitely a cool pattern here. Let me ask you real quick then, is there anything aside from the authentication stuff that anybody who might be interested in the Office 365 APIs, did we leverage those in any way in these samples?
So when it comes to the Office 365 APIs, mostly what we did was we just leveraged its authentication capabilities. And the reason for that is that at this point in the preview, the support for SharePoint doesn't include abstracted clients that get to everything we need. For those that aren't familiar with the Office 365 APIs, the idea is not only to abstract OAuth, but to abstract a lot of the normal REST calls you would make and just sort of turning them into methods of objects. However, at this point in the previews, the abstracted objects that Microsoft has provided us for SharePoint Online is really limited to just a few things like files, and we couldn't get to the list using any kind of abstracted object, so we had to fall back to making REST calls ourselves. But that's fine. You can do that with the Office 365 APIs because it will give you an OAuth token, and then you can simply grab that OAuth token and make your REST calls from the server.
I see. Oh, that's very cool. Well, this has been really helpful. I hope that our listeners have gotten something out of this. At least they understand a little bit of a new pattern, an additional pattern, I should say, to their toolbox, to where they can build apps and not have them build like more line of business apps that don't require some special registration in SharePoint or working with the SharePoint app model. Instead, leveraging the app model, but not having to deploy SharePoint apps and kind of have less of a SharePoint understanding in a sense. And being able to work more in these more Azure-based or ASP.NET-based technologies and not such have a deep SharePoint understanding. Let me ask you then, where can users go to get additional information about this or obtain the projects and stuff and learn more about this?
All right. So, well, I'm sure you're going to have the links to the GitHub project, which is now published and available. And also, you did a video that talks a little bit more about the installation and architecture of this. So we'll have a link to that, I'm sure, at the end. Mm-hmm. And then I've been writing up some of these concepts in a little bit more detail. So if this discussion here went a little fast, or you're looking for, some diagrams and some code snippets, then the best thing to do is go up to IT Unity. So itunity.com. And if you look for me under the author section, you'll find a series I'm working on this very pattern of creating applications in Azure that use SharePoint like a resource as opposed to launching from within SharePoint. So I think those are three great places to find more about what we're talking about. And I would, I'd really want to emphasize for anybody right at the end here is just that this isn't some sort of interesting academic pattern that maybe you want to fool around with. I really think that this pattern of building more classic web applications and then treating SharePoint like it's a data resource is going to be a a more significant pattern that is going to emerge over the next couple of years here as one that might even be preferred over some of the things that we're doing now. So I think this is an important thing for people to start to take a look at.
Mm. Very cool. Well, Scott, thanks a lot for your time. I'll make sure that we have all these notes in the show notes when we publish this episode so everybody can go grab those things. Just go to the MicrosoftCloudShow.com website, go find this episode, and you'll find all the links and stuff that we've talked about here. So as well as information about Scott, where can they find you, Scott, if they want to follow you or find out more information about what you're doing these days?
Yeah, so you gave out my email at the beginning. It's scott@scotthillier.net, but you can also follow me on Twitter. It's simple enough. It's @ScottHillier is one word.
There you go. Fantastic. And that's Scott with one T.
That's right. Always one T.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot for your time today, Scott. I really do appreciate it.
All right, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
There you have our discussion with Scott about these different scenarios. Now, there's two things I really want to call out here from these applications that I think is really a big thing that I took away from this, or something that I really like about it. And you can read between the lines of what I'm saying and think that I'm trying to say something negative about 365 or SharePoint, and that's not the case at all. The thing that I really like about these applications is that you don't have to have really any experience at all in working with Office 365 or with SharePoint specifically as a SharePoint developer or as a 365 developer to build these applications, because everything that we did was just based on REST APIs. They're about open REST APIs that are fully documented. All we did was create lists inside of SharePoint, which to a non-SharePoint person could just be a table in a database. You just think, how do I create one of these things? SharePoint calls them lists. Somebody else calls them repositories. Somebody else calls them containers. And that these guys call them, or some other people call them, tables. That's one. And the other thing is that we also had to deal with having some sort of an intermediary application. And in our case, we made that an ASP.NET MVC web API application so that none of our three samples that we created, either the single page application or the Outlook web app add-in or the Microsoft Word task pane add-in, none of those talk directly to SharePoint. All of them go through a backend or an intermediary server-side application that then talk to Office 365 on our behalf. And the main reason for that is because we were trying to show the best pattern that we possibly could to secure this access token. We wanted to make sure that this access token that we got back from Office 365 was not exposed to the client. There's a lot of debate on, you know, is it okay to pass it back to the client because, you know, it's over SSL, then we're good. But the only risk you have there is that the client gets compromised. But in our case, we wanted to say, nope, we're going to follow the other side of the camp, which says access token should never touch the client. And so we're going to store everything server side and have our three different application implementations have some way to authenticate and identify themselves with that intermediary and have the intermediary store and hold that access token on our behalf so that we never see it.
Yeah. I love the flexibility that this model gives you, right? Because it means that you're hiding a bunch of that complexity from the client, and it means that you can choose how you want to talk between the client and your server application, and that is not dependent on what you can do between a client and, say, Office 365. You could choose, say, web API, or you could do roll your own, or you could choose whatever you want in that implementation. And then on the back end, you've hidden all of that, or you've abstracted that away from the client, and you can it gives you the flexibility of doing like server-side caching. You could do all sorts of different things there, right? Encrypt stuff, you know, anything you like on the back end, and you're not having to worry about that from the client.
Yeah. And all these intermediary applications, they all live inside of Azure. So they all live as Azure websites. They all leverage the Azure Active Directory, and the applications that we created or we defined through the web interface in Azure Active Directory and gave these applications specific permissions to do things inside of 365. So we could say, you know, that these applications are allowed to do these things as long as the users also have access to do these things. It works very much like a SharePoint or an Office 365 application already works, but we didn't have to do any of this stuff inside of the 365 interface And we're able to do everything inside of Azure. So really, you know, you could think about all the different kinds of things you could build here and have your own custom line of business applications that could really go through and take advantage of 365 without having to do any changes inside of 365.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's nice. So where can people find this?
So you can find everything. The projects, we'll put a link to the blog post that your team put up on the blogs.office.com site. That'll be in the show notes. Well, the code that you can grab that today, fork it, make changes to it, whatever you like. Submit pull requests inside of the GitHub account for Office Dev. You'll see a project called the Research Project Tracker. That's the one that Scott and I did. And then we also have a video, and we'll link to that as well, that is a walkthrough. It's about 67 minutes long that I went through and explained the architecture and how we set everything up, and a demo of the applications and the code as well. Up on Channel 9. So all those links, we'll put those in the show notes. They'll be live when the show goes live, so go grab everything from there.
Very cool indeed. Yeah, I'll definitely be picking through it in more detail in the coming weeks.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I guess that's everything we want to touch on in this show. We didn't want to make this too long here, so let's go ahead and wrap it up and... everyone, I guess your call to action is to go take a look at this stuff. See what you think. The other thing too, hey, everybody that's listening to the show, we'd love to have conversations with you guys. Jump into the blog. Jump into the comments for these posts. They're all up on our website, microsoftcloudshow.com. Go to the episode. Yeah, tweet us. Talk about it. Let's have a conversation about this stuff. We want to get some more interaction with the listeners here and not just CJ and I just spouting off. So let's...
Hey, I've got an idea I'm just going to throw out randomly here. Why don't we get a listener to email us a little brief on one of the projects that they're working on in the cloud, and we'll take a look at those. We'll take a look at the submissions, and pick a couple, and maybe invite people on the show, or at least read them out and talk about them.
Let's talk about real world stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's do that.
So email your ideas and real world projects you're working on in the cloud, whether it be in AWS or in Azure or Google or Rackspace or wherever, and let us know on what you're working on, interesting projects you're doing, and we'll talk about them on the show.
Absolutely. Love the idea. Mike, go to microsoftcloudshow.com, submit them that way, put them on Twitter. We'll get in touch with you. We'll start an email dialogue and go from there.
Sounds great.
Cool. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 file and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can find us on Facebook searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.